This show is sponsored by Qualitest. Deploy software that you and your customers trust with Qualitest Testing and Business Assurance Services. Learn more about Qualitest at qualitestgroup.com. Hello and welcome to The Testing Show. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Michael Larson, your show producer, and we have a full house this go around. Let's give a welcome to our regulars, Jessica and Grasolino.
Hey there.
Herzi Ababa.
Hello, everyone.
Justin Rohrman.
Good morning.
Matt Heuser.
Welcome back.
And we have two guests today. Let's welcome Pete Whalen.
Hello.
And also, please welcome Cassandra Lung.
Yay. Well done. Thank you.
And Matt, it's your show. I'm turning it over to you.
Thanks, Michael. So we know most of the regulars, but you might not know Cassandra, who I've met recently through Twitter. And Pete, well, let's just say we go way back. Cassandra, I know you're a quality specialist in the UK with an interest in usability. Tell us a little bit about how you think about testing and how you work.
Yes, so I just actually finished up a role with my official job title of UX Ninja. The way that came about is because there was a lot of different things that I did within my role, but always had a focus on user experience. As a recording, I'm due to start a new role in Germany next week. The official job title there is test engineer, so not quite so exciting, but I'm definitely still planning to, you know, bring that focus on user experience. One of the things that I always kind of think about is just because it works doesn't mean that it's good or that anyone's going to, you know, want to use it or that it's easy to use, etc., etc. For me, user experience is always a big focus in testing. I think it's one of those non-functional requirements, but for me, you know, if people can't use it, then it's not really functioning.
All right. Now, Pete's at Salesforce. He's been there for a couple years now. You seem to be having fun.
Yeah, doing loads of API testing, more into the underlying code, C#, Java, all kinds of cool stuff. Loads of SQL.
Pete was a former board member of the Association for Software Testing. We did a lot of conference-y stuff together, active in helping keep Grand Rapids testers alive, and as an organizer for several years. Kind of backed off from that. I guess you're just having too much fun doing testing.
Well, and sometimes schedules collide.
Yeah. Also, you're in a pipe band, right? You're a drummer.
Yes, I hit things. Yeah, currently I'm playing in a competition band from Windsor, Ontario, and I'm also teaching the Muskegon Police pipes and drums from Muskegon, Michigan.
That's awesome. So let's talk about what's new and interesting in the world of software testing. I'm going to start with Microsoft. Has anyone here heard of the Unified Windows Platform?
No.
UWP? Can't say that I have.
I hadn't either. Microsoft is apparently creating a unified Windows platform that is going to be phones, tablets, laptops, desktops, and holographic lenses.
I didn't
realize that. Yeah.
Well, they do have this product called the HoloLens, which is right. A really decent augmented reality tool. I visited a vendor/partner with the company at the beginning of this year, and they had a demo in one of their R&D labs that showed, I think it looked like a nuclear pipeline. Aside from having the ability to zoom in and out of what's outside and inside the buildings, you wear this thing on your head like an Oculus. So you scroll up with your hand so you can dig deeper and look into what's happening like 200 feet below the ground. It's really cool. It's a pretty interesting way to either play games if you like Minecraft or just look into architecture. There's a ton of applications in medicine when they improve that platform. Yeah, it's a very interesting piece of technology.
So one of the things that would probably be helpful with this is that Windows 10, at least at this point, determines things based on classes of devices or what they call device families. The idea here is that they want to be able to say you've got one Windows platform and that Windows platform can be tailored for a number of device families. The universal device family consists of desktop, mobile, Xbox, IoT, IoT headless, and HoloLens. That's the full suite of device families that you can play with in the Windows 10 sphere.
We'll see how it turns out. Windows 8 was, let's make one unified Windows operating system, and it made your laptop feel like a tablet, and it just didn't work. Now they're saying, we're going to do it again. I realize that it's modularized, compartmentalized, customized, and supposed to be all different, but share the same code base.
It also looks like the Universal Device Family is special. It is not directly the foundation of any OS. Instead, the set of APIs in the Universal Device Family is inherited by the Child Device Family. Universal Device Family APIs are thus guaranteed to be present in every OS and on every device. So take that for what it's worth. So
what's interesting to me is the availability of an issues list that they're going to open up to the public. And I think in the past year or so, I believe they put out like a public issues list for the browser that they're developing, which is the Edge. And it's not just that, but they actually give you access to the features that they're developing for that particular technology. So the Edge HTML rendering engine, for example, which is exactly the same way the folks from WebKit or the folks from Google and Opera have done as they push new versions every 6 weeks. It's pretty interesting. From the old model where you're just looking at what bugs they're going to fix during patch Tuesdays compared to seeing what's happening, whether something is fixed, whether it's something that they decide not to fix, I think it's good for the public.
Yeah, as a person who works in a open product that's built on top of a closed product, we open source all of our code and we open source our automated tests. Like everything is open. People can go in. And we have a lot of community members who push issues, but then we have a community manager who is technical enough to understand the product. She knows the documentation and she steps in to talk to the community and walk them through that stuff. So hopefully they're doing their due diligence and saying, if we're going to open up this bug tracker, then we're going to make sure we're engaging with people and only pushing actual issues into some kind of a workflow.
So speaking of complete, consistent, correct, and ambiguous, Percy pointed us to this software verification competition.
Right. So there is, apparently this happens yearly, the competition in software verification, and it's held in Uppsala, Sweden. The key motivation that they have for this competition is the invention of new methods, technologies, and tools just looks into very specific areas of software development where they can perform verification of whether something within the software can happen or not. They're actually looking for very distinct verification tasks. They're looking for, if you have a function or a method, is there a way for a particular error statement that the system would never hit that error statement? The other assumption that they're looking into is whether they can model atomic execution of the sequence of statements and whether it's a single-threaded or multi-threaded runs. It's pretty academic for me. A lot of it really goes beyond my head, but nevertheless, it was pretty interesting. And the other thing that I found pretty interesting too is that they actually declared what their assumptions are. A lot of this, they're using Java and C as the code base for their competition, and they're assuming that the memory allocation command will always return a valid pointer. Based on my personal experience, that is never the case. There's always weird stuff happening there. The other assumption that they have is that the free command always deallocates any memory they want to be able to deallocate. So it's pretty interesting, very heavy participation within the universities. The one that won this year, it's a professor out of the Queen Mary University in London.
That reminds me a little bit of the DeepSpec event I went to last summer. What they were trying to do there was create proofs in the mathematical sense. They would create these proofs that software does something. A lot of the time what they were doing was taking a programming language like C and then taking the specification for C and writing a proof in these very low-level other programming languages to see that the language was doing what the C specification said. So like you said, it's actually verification of a specification. It's not testing. They're not going around exploring what happens. They're actually verifying the specification. And it was also mostly academic practitioners and then some very low-level libraries. Embedded device company, there were some people from Intel. There are people from Google working on SSH libraries and things like that. So if there was a very, very, very detailed spec, they could verify that the software was adhering to that specification.
Yeah, like very straightforward input-output text-based stuff.
Yeah.
That can be described in an algorithm.
And you that say, can be described in something that looks like a geometry proof.
And then you say, does it correspond to that?
Yep.
Which, in theory, some dialog boxes could do that. And then
It's not going to be applicable for a web app. This is for, like, very low-level software. Like, the software that runs airplanes or cars or medical devices, things like that. Stuff that's small enough to be embedded on one chip.
Yep. We have many problems with more human interface complex software. One being there's no way we're going to get the spec written as a geometry proof. That's just not going to happen. Instead, we're going to get stories, which is a placeholder for a conversation, or use cases, or some companies still do specs, but they look more like a bunch of screenshots. Make it look like this. That puts the tester in the position of saying, this is a bug, and someone else saying, no, it's not. Both these new stories circle around that, whereas automated specification stuff simply doesn't know it's a problem if it exists outside the spec.
Right.
And most of us work with specs that are not clear enough that we can do that anyway.
Yeah, so most of the detailed specification people sort of worked their way around that. Like, they were aware that specifications were inherently wrong and incomplete and easy to misinterpret and all of this good stuff. So they would do what they called fuzz testing, which is basically blasting an input variable with loads of data constantly, just hoping to magically find bugs.
And of course, you also run into the situation, whether or not this is an intended consequence of Agile, tends to be a consequence of Agile, in which there really is no spec. You kind of get some hand wavy, well, here's what we'd like to do based on some output detail, and let's go. It's good for incremental programming, but it can be very lousy for putting together test ideas and test approaches, because sometimes the functionality is so vaguely described that anything that you do that goes alter to that can totally throw a project into pandemonium. And I've had recent experience with that. That's why I'm saying it.
I think Cassie was the one that actually originally proposed this topic. Tell us about some of your adventures with not quite detailed enough specs.
Yeah, I think what Michael was saying about you don't really get a lot of specifications or requirements that just kind of, you know, put it together, see what you get. I think someone else mentioned as well, sometimes it's even just screenshots of, you know, we want it to look like this, and without any actual more detailed information about, okay, well, you've got this button here. What is that supposed to do? What's the intent behind that? How does that relate to the story? I was kind of thinking of, it's almost a little bit trying to solve some sort of algebra problem, ideally what we would end up with, but what are the pieces, what's the X, Y, and Z that led you to get there? And I think from a testing perspective, when you only have a user story to test with, that's the problem that you're trying to solve, but there could be many possible solutions. And it might not be very clear which solution the business was actually intending to go with. If there was a particular solution or even just a feature of it, a specific part that they've rejected, that they've specifically decided not to do for a particular reason, then you don't know what the background is. I guess with that algebra thing, I was kind of thinking of, you know, in school you get points for the right answer, but you also get points for showing you're working. And it's, you know, that showing you're working that I think really helps me as a tester, just to try and understand, you know, the path of how we got there. You know, someone might see X as a bug, but someone else says, oh, no, that's fine, or why is it built that way? Again, what benefit does that have to a user story? So what I often find myself doing when, you know, when I don't have so-called complete requirements, when a requirement's ever complete, think about what is the problem we're trying to solve, and as a user, what would I expect? What would I like? What is annoying me about what I've got in front of me just now? That comes from experience of your user base. You know, as we always say, you're not your user, but you can try hard to put yourself in their shoes. And I think with a bit of experience from, you know, what your user base is like currently, what the target market is that you're looking for, you know, maybe it's not your current user base. Maybe this is a completely different product that you're trying to work on to engage a different part of the market and that you haven't tapped into yet. Just think of that. And, you know, if I was this person, if I was using this, would that be a solution to me? What's this thing over here? I'm kind of being distracted. Or might even be something like, oh, it was great once I worked out what on earth I was doing. It was really, really hard to use. You can ask, who was it that put together whatever it is that you've got in front of you, whether it's, you know, spec requirements, user story, a screenshot, who provided that to you? Do you have access to them? Have you got the time to go and speak to them, have a conversation about it? Have you got access to the developer who maybe has a lot more information that's not written down? I think there's a lot we can do to look outside of what has just been handed to us.
Very often when I'll have a conversation about requirements or lack thereof or vagueness about it, is I will point out and say, here are some things we can do. Here are some things that we can test. Here's the time that we have. Now realize I'm not in a position to make the ultimate decision for what we want to do here, but I want to give you as much information as I can. And then I will let you all decide how we want to work with this. we're not here to babysit your product. We're here to ask questions, get information, and provide you avenues to consider to make your decision. It's also up to us to push back and say, here's some questions that I have, and from past experience, I think we have some areas here that we need to investigate that we haven't, or we haven't defined, or we don't even really realize that this is going to be a problem. And based on other stories that we have dealt with, where we thought it was going to be so simple, a little introduction, a little new feature, and it took us months to test, and ultimately a story broke down into 24 stories, for example, just to be able to get our head around everything. That's a reality, and it happens to even the best and most diligent companies. So I think it's important for us as testers to be on the lookout to say, I don't think that this is well defined, and I'm not trying to be a jerk about this or get a defensive reaction. I want you to realize that through experience, we've been here before, and we don't have to be here.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It is important for us to be able to provide the decision makers with as much information as is reasonable to make that informed decision. But as you say, to also keep in mind that they are the decision makers. As much as we want to or be able to work towards a good quality product, we don't want to become, you know, what's known as the goalkeepers, the safety net. We don't want people to just think that cobble together whatever and the testers will sort it out. That's not what we're here for. What we are here for is to take a risk-based approach, to have a look at what we've got in front of us, to gather some information. And if possible, what I think is really important for testers who want to go beyond the activity of testing is to be able to provide some insight from that. What is the consequence of us leaving something the way that it is just now? Or what will we gain from fixing this particular issue? And that's the sort of information that I think, you know, decision makers will be able to do something with, as opposed to, I found X number of things in this part of the system. What does that mean? Give me something more than that.
I think that's really an important concept, and I think a lot of people aren't as aware of it as they could be. The idea of asking questions to gain information for yourself, but also to help enlighten other people, the stakeholders, whoever may be involved, around what happens, what's the implication, what's the result of doing this. I think that a lot of stories get written with a great deal of tribal knowledge where it's implied, but not necessarily explicitly stated. If you're dealing with stuff that you as a tester may not be that familiar with, you're going to look at it and go, there's 20 words here. I've got no idea what they mean. And so you may find yourself at a point where you need to dig and start asking questions and asking what if, as you pointed out, the greater question that we have as a tester is how do we do those conversations? It's great to say, yeah, you need to have the conversation. But I think the challenge for a lot of people, and sometimes myself included, is to say, how do we do the conversation? How do we start that? How do we begin that question? Because that's where a lot of people will almost automatically say, well, it's in the story or it's over here. Getting beyond those first knee-jerk reactions is sometimes for a lot of testers, especially junior testers, extremely hard.
They are really tough conversations to have, and I don't want to go too vague on this, but I think it's one of these areas where your personal relationships, they really come into play to be able to know the individual that you're needing to approach. What's the experience of them been like in the past? How do they tend to take these conversations a little bit better? Some people really like it if you just walk up to them at their desk and start having a conversation. For other people, that really knocks them off their flow, and that's a couple of hours lost where they try and get back in the zone, if you like, and then they prefer, you know, like an email or a meeting or something like that. And I think if you know people that you're working with a little bit, if you try and build those relationships and try and get a bit personal with them, then it can be easier to know how to adapt your approach to each person.
This thing keeps coming up with some of our clients where the stories are just horribly defined. It's hard for me not to get judgmental. Literally, I've asked a programmer what the software is supposed to do. What is the purpose of this software? And usually I'm in sort of a tangential role, consulting role, account management role. It's not my business, but it's not going well. And the programmer has said, I don't know, I just implement the stories. That's really bad, right? So maybe we could talk about two things. One, how does this happen? Is it just me? Is there some root cause? And then what can testers do to, even in that tough situation, to do better?
We have an interesting model in the fact that we have a distributed organization. And in some ways, I think that social text struggles with the fact that we also have to fit into a larger corporate culture now that we're no longer the masters of our own domain because of being acquired. And it just seems like what made sense just a short while ago that was really easy to get your head around is now wrapped up into dependencies and aspects that you think you understand your requirements. You think you understand what you're programming, but you're now dependent on features and sets for products that you don't even have control over. This is your own company and their peripheral unit. You're trying to talk to each other and you're using totally different languages. You're using totally different tools, totally different development techniques, but you have to interoperate and interact. And I think this is where sometimes you can get into that situation of there is so much overhead just to do the most simple thing that it can be a knee-jerk reaction to just say, I'm going to focus on what I have some control over, and that's it. And then later on, we as testers, and when you start to ask questions, that's that group, or you need to talk to this person. No, you need to talk to this person. No, there's this other group that handles that, and it just becomes very tiresome and very frustrating. That's a real question that I have. Not just how do you define your immediate product, but how do you define the greater whole so that it makes sense?
I'm going to jump in here and be my researchy social scientist self, because I really believe something that I've had success with as a tester is communicating with the rest of the organization. I've not experienced problems communicating with devs. I'm very strategic. To do that, I've read Critical Conversations, which is a book about how to approach difficult situations, Stephen Brookfield's Discussions as a Way of Teaching, to look into how to address discussions with adults in a way that's informative rather than instructive. And I've used other techniques, which I've talked about before on the show, but I do think that there is not necessarily solution, that would imply something very pointed. I do think that there are strategies that can come from the social sciences and psychology that, when applied in these situations, can yield results that are positive for everybody involved, as long as the parties are willing to talk.
I agree that talking helps and getting to who is the end customer. I think there's also a place for leadership. One thing I think testers can do in the face of a vague spec is say, this is what it should do. And there's two things that will happen. Either that'll be accepted and that'll be fine. That's what it does. Or someone with authority will say, no, tester, you're wrong. It should do this other thing. And you say, great, because now I have an oracle. So now we have to find what it should do. So now I can know if things are bugs or not. Now I can know what correct behavior is. So the very act of speaking, this is what the software should do, can force later decisions. And for some reason, lots of people are afraid to do that. But that's one way to deal with, I think, this is it a bug or not problems.
I think people fear responsibility. You know, if you claim that it's what it should do, and then somebody comes back and is like, you're totally wrong, and that's messed up. People don't really, they're not dying to put themselves in that situation, even if it's important to do so.
I think when you make those strong claims, though, that it forces other people to have these visceral reactions, and then you find out the truth. Maybe you look kind of dumb in the moment because they think this person obviously doesn't know what they're talking about, but you finally get to an answer by doing that, by saying that something that's just obviously wrong.
Isn't that part of the beauty of being a tester, though? Like, I'm just dumb as the tester. I don't know. Look at me. I'm just a tester. Like, I'm not very good. I just thought it should be that. I guess you're right. Gosh, you're so smart. Like, you've got to do that in a non-ironic, not sarcastic way, which, as you can tell, I'm not very good at, but that tends to be accepted. The other possibility is that you start a war and you lose by 49%. Some big, powerful people come in and say, no, it's like this, and most of the technical staff is with you, but for whatever reason, and you waste some time fighting stupid argument. But at least that demonstrates that this is a thing that reasonable people could disagree about, and you're not crazy.
I think you mentioned it earlier, Matt, specifically on the idea of very subjective things that you can have in a given team. When you ask a question, it boils down to either ignorance, apathy, or they don't care because they need to get their job done. I guess from a subjective perspective, it depends on the culture of your team, whether those types of conversations are going to be helpful or are they going to bring harm to your relationship with the developer. That also depends on your product knowledge, your skill as a tester, among all of these things. I definitely agree with what everyone has been saying. You just don't take a requirement face value.
I would agree with that. Definitely got experiences of that where making a conscious effort to be really clear about what I'm trying to portray, but always got that bias of we know what we're trying to say. So then when someone else, most likely a developer, comes and says, what is this? I didn't understand what this is. Or alternatively, you know, if you get something back and it's like, gosh, why have they done that? That's not what I asked for at all. And then by having a conversation and help me understand what it was that I did that caused a misunderstanding, then you're putting the onus on yourself and you're accepting that you have a part to play in something not quite going right. And then it's also an opportunity for you to understand from someone else's perspective that, oh yeah, actually what I said there was really ambiguous. Yeah, I can really understand why that's confused you. And then to also ask for feedback and say, okay, how could I put that better for you? And then that way that hopefully sets you up in other people's eyes as someone who can be given feedback, someone who can look at themselves critically.
Okay, thank you, Cassie. Unfortunately, we're running tight on time. I'll start with Pete and Cassie. Where can people go to learn more about you and what you're working on and what are you working on these days that's public and shareable?
I'm on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter and I tweet a whole bunch of weird combination of things, everything from software testing to facts, which are kind of rare apparently, things like this day in history, because there always tends to be a cycle. Also pipe band stuff. So my pipe band followers get really confused when I'm tweeting about software testing. But anyway, you can find me on Twitter at Pete Whalen, W-A-L-E-N. That's me. You can also find my blog, Rhythm of Testing, at blogspot.com. And of course, at GR Testers, come on by.
So I am pretty active on Twitter, at tweet underscore Cassandra, C-A-S-S-A-N-D-R-A, to sort of take part in discussions that I see on there, but also to kind of put out some of my own mind clouds that just sort of flutter around, see what other people think about them. And then sometimes I turn those ideas and thoughts into blogs as well. A blog at www.cassandrahl.com. Starting a new job soon as well. I also recently found out that I'll be speaking at Agile Testing Days in November. I believe Pete's speaking there as well, so it'd be great to meet more people from the community.
What are you talking about, Cassie?
I'm talking about five ways automation is like six. And it's not because six sales, because I really do see a comparison there.
Okay, then. So my talk, I'm also going to be at Agilist Days, is do you even need to automate the GUI? I expect to be booed and have things thrown at me. Yeah, but we'll see.
So just quickly, I'm doing a virtual talk for Python Day in Mexico. They're working up toward having a full PyCon conference, but this year they're just doing one day. So I will be talking about using Python along with Behave, which is a cucumber-like tool, and how to do the things that Matt says we don't need to do. So that should be interesting.
All right. Well, for me, you can find me at a local NYC Testers meetup. So check us out. We try to have one every month.
I'm continuing to work on CAST 2017. That will be in Nashville, Tennessee, August 16th, 17th, and 18th. Tickets are on sale now.
And Test Retreat is the day after
CAST. Test Retreat is Saturday, August 19th. It's a 19th. Full day on conference.
Questions you want to talk to us, email thetestingshow@qualitestgroup.com, and we'll be here again in two more weeks. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Testing Show, sponsored by Qualitest. For more information, please see www.qualitestgroup.com. Do you have questions? Or is there a topic or an idea you'd like to have covered? Please email us at thetestingshow@qualitestgroup.com, and we will answer questions we receive on air.